Hello, and welcome to Historically Speaking, Uncommon History with an Unconventional Pair. I'm Rebecca Robbins.
And I'm Kim Kimmel.
I'm a singer and actress.
And I'm a retired history teacher.
He was my history teacher in college.
And now we've been married for 21 years.
Sometimes quirky, sometimes obscure.
But this is the kind of history you actually want to remember.
Hello, and welcome to episode 16 of Historically Speaking Podcast. Here we are, this last day of February recording, and it will come out the first Wednesday of March.
Yes.
So we're bi-monthly here.
Yes, can't wait for March.
Cannot wait for March. So true.
Yes.
So today we're going to cover controversial Supreme Court cases, and there have been several.
Oh my gosh. There's a ton of them. We have to reduce it to just about 8 or 9 or 10 or something like that.
Can we just start with, when was the Supreme Court established?
It was established with the Constitution of the United States, Article 3. It went into operation the same year as the executive branch did, the presidency, and the legislative branch, Congress, House of Representatives, and the Senate, 1789. So
okay.
It has been in existence right from the get-go.
And how many people were on it initially?
Well, between 1789 and 1869, it fluctuated. There were anywhere from 5 to 10 justices, because in Article 3, as many as 10, in Article 3 of the Constitution, it does not prescribe what the number of Supreme Court justices should be. And so it is up to Congress to make that determination. They could make it 20 if they wanted to.
I would think an uneven number would be ideal.
I think an uneven number is a better idea, yes, than an even number. But there were 5 to 10 between 1789 and 1869. Since 1869, there have been 9, and that has not changed. Now, FDR in the 1930s suggested increasing it because some of his New Deal programs were being overruled by a conservative Supreme Court, but that didn't fly very well. And there have been suggestions very recently.
Very recently, as
to increase
the last
Supreme
election.
Court, yes. I think there's going to be a lot of pushback against that. But there have been 9 justices since 1869.
But there's no law, there's no document that says
it's
Congress's, you have to have this many.
Nope. Congress can establish whatever number they want.
Interesting.
Yes. Just as Congress establishes the inferior courts of the Supreme Court, which are the circuit courts of appeal and the federal district courts.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
All right. So you ready to dive in?
Yes. So we will start with probably the single most famous Supreme Court case of all time. I think almost every constitutional law professor would agree with this. This is the 1803 case, Marbury versus Madison. Now, John Marshall was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court at this time. He would be Chief Justice from 1801 to his death in 1835. John Marshall is looked upon as probably the single most important justice in the entire history of the Supreme Court because he formed so much of constitutional law in the early years of the American Republic.
So he set the precedent for many of these cases.
Absolutely. And he was a brilliant individual. He was from Virginia. He was born in 1755, died in 1835, wrote a multi-volume biography of George Washington, was steeped in the law, had a razor-sharp intellect, and he very much wanted to make the new American nation as strong as possible. So a lot of his decisions were based with that in mind. And Marbury versus Madison, it's a very obscure beginning. A man named William Marbury was made Justice of the Peace in D.C. in the last days of John Adams' administration, because John Adams had just lost the 1800 election. Remember where we covered that?
Yes, which we've covered actually in a couple episodes.
Yeah, where Burr and Jefferson both got 73 electoral votes.
Yep.
So Adams was on his way out. And a day or two before he left office in March of 1801, he made William Marbury Justice of the Peace in Washington, D.C. So Adams leaves, Jefferson comes in as president, and Jefferson's Secretary of State, James Madison, refused to deliver the required notice and official documentation for William Marbury to become Justice of the Peace, because William Marbury, like John Adams, was a Federalist, and Thomas Jefferson and James Madison were Democratic Republicans, opposite parties. So Marbury sued. Right? He sued to have a writ of mandamus, which is a court order to do something, and it went right to the Supreme Court because the 1789 Judiciary Act said that in writs of mandamus, the Supreme Court had original jurisdiction.
Okay.
I
just want to make sure I understand this.
Yes.
Adams said, hey, I'm going to make you Justice of the Peace.
Yeah, this is like a day or two before he left office.
And here's the paperwork. File the paperwork after I'm gone.
Well, yeah, it would take a week or 2 weeks or something like that to get
meanwhile,
it all.
Meanwhile,
Jefferson becomes president and refuses to deliver.
It's like, oops, I lost the paperwork.
Well, no, they didn't know. They didn't say they lost the paperwork. They just said, we're not going to deliver your Justice of the Peace.
That's just mean.
Well, there's a lot of meanness in politics.
I know.
You know, I mean, don't forget that Jefferson and Adams were very much political enemies at the time, but in old age, they became very good friends.
That's amazing.
And they wrote wonderful letters
to each
other.
Maybe there's hope for Trump and Nancy Pelosi.
I don't know that I would go that far.
Okay. I just thought I'd throw it out there.
That would be a whole new level
of reconciliation.
Yes, absolutely. It makes the Adam Jefferson feud look quite mild by comparison. Anyway, the commission was not delivered. And so Marbury sued pursuant to the 1789 Judiciary Act that said that the Supreme Court apparently had original jurisdiction. Well, John Marshall, who was Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and this was a unanimous decision, said that, oh yeah, Marbury was entitled to his commission and he should have gotten it. But the 1789 Judiciary Act was unconstitutional because it gave the Supreme Court original jurisdiction over a matter that it should not have original jurisdiction. It could only have appellate jurisdiction. So Marbury had no remedy. Now, Marbury was refused his commission because the Supreme Court under John Marshall said that they didn't have the proper jurisdiction to do it.
But it's the Supreme Court.
But the larger point is here, and this is why it's such an important case. John Marshall is stating in Marbury versus Madison that it is the Supreme Court of the United States that decides what's constitutional and what isn't. It's not the president. It's not the Congress. It's the Supreme Court. And so Marshall invalidated Section 13 of the 1789 Judiciary Act. Poor Marbury didn't get his commission, and Marbury was...
And he had no recourse after that.
No, that's right. Marbury was a Federalist like Marshall, so Marshall would have liked to have had him had the commission, but a much larger principle was established, and that was that the Supreme Court would determine what was constitutional and what was not. And that is good law to this day. Jefferson was furious. President Jefferson was furious with the decision. He thought that Marshall had given the Supreme Court way too much power, but it stuck.
So I'm trying to understand the actual decision.
The actual decision was Marbury deserved his commission, but it cannot be delivered because the Judiciary Act unconstitutionally gave the Supreme Court original jurisdiction over a writ of mandamus. Therefore,
But the problem with the filing, if they would have filed their complaint with a lesser court...
It might have gone through, right. But the way the Judiciary Act was stated, it seemed as though a writ of mandamus... You see, in the Constitution, the Supreme Court has original jurisdiction only in two areas, with state versus state and with ambassadors from other countries. Everything else for the Supreme Court is appellate jurisdiction. So the writ of mandamus, which was read by Marshall as something that gave the Supreme Court original jurisdiction, was unconstitutional.
Wow.
So he invalidated Section 13 of the 1789 Judicial Act. This gave the Supreme Court in future decades, to this very day,
for all time,
enormous power. That's why Marbury versus Madison, even though it was over this very minor matter of delivering the commission for the Justice of the Peace in D.C. to Marbury, it had enormous consequences.
Wow.
And Marbury versus Madison is the Supreme Court case of all time to this
day. Basically, would you say it's what began the Supreme Court as we know it today?
In a way, yes. Up until 1803, there was a question as to who would determine whether something was constitutional or not constitutional. A lot of state Supreme Courts thought that they did not have to defer to the federal Supreme Court, but that was overruled in 1816 with a case called Martin versus Hunter's Lessee. So the Supreme Court under Marshall gathers more and more and more power.
Just because that's the way he read it in the Constitution.
That's right. And he felt that a fledgling nation like the American Republic needed a strong central government, including a strong central judiciary. And so Marshall's decisions, and keep in mind, he was Chief Justice for 34 years.
That's a long time to have power.
That is a very long time. And he really formulated a constitutional law more than any other single justice in the history of the United States Supreme Court.
So he is the grandfather of the Supreme Court.
Yeah, he is the ultimate justice in the entire history. And the Supreme Court has produced many, many capable justices. But I think you'd have to put John Marshall right there
as number
at the top.
One.
Yeah, Marbury versus Madison.
Wow.
Still
okay.
Good law to this day.
All right, so what's our next one?
Our next one is the very next case when the Supreme Court overturned a federal law. And this, we jumped the whole way to 1857.
Okay.
This is Dred Scott decision. Dred Scott decision is...
It's funny, it's one of those things I've heard of, but I'm not sure I know exactly what it is.
Yeah, it's technically Scott versus Sanford. That's the technical name of the case, but it's usually just referred to as the Dred Scott decision. Dred Scott was a black slave in Missouri. His master...
And that was his name, Dred?
Dred Scott. Scott. Mm-hmm. Dred
okay.
Scott. And his master, Dr. John Emerson, while he was still living, Emerson was, he took Scott to a free state, Illinois, and he took him to a free territory, Wisconsin Territory. Well, he ends up back in Missouri. Emerson eventually dies.
Dred Scott... Wait, he took him there to say,
on
vacation?
No, not on vacation, as a servant. You know.
Oh, I see.
You know, a lot of black slaves were domestic servants, not field hands. And he was a domestic servant.
So he didn't take it for the purpose of releasing him in a free
state. No. He just took him to Illinois and Wisconsin Territory because of some professional trips he had to take.
I see. Okay.
Okay. But he ends up back in Missouri. Dr. John Emerson dies. Dred Scott, as property, is passed on to Dr. Emerson's sister. And she puts her brother in charge of this. His name is Sanford. That's why the case is Scott versus Sanford. Well, Dred Scott sued for his freedom on the basis that since he had been in a free state, Illinois, and a free territory, Wisconsin Territory, he was therefore free. What's interesting is the state of Missouri, which was a slave state, had a precept that once free, always free. So the lower Missouri court said, yes, Dred Scott is a free man.
Because he was taken to those free
territories. That's right. But it went to the Missouri State Supreme Court, and the state Supreme Court said, no, he's not a free man. So eventually, it goes the whole way to the federal Supreme Court. And this is over many years. I mean, Dred Scott sued for his freedom somewhere around 1846.
So meanwhile, he's still a slave.
That's right.
I can't imagine they were treating him well at this point.
Well, I don't know about the personal treatment of Dred Scott. I don't know that. But he sued for his freedom, and it took years and years to reach the Supreme Court. In 1857, in March, the Supreme Court, and the Chief Justice at that time was Roger B. Taney, it issued a decision, it was a 7-2 decision, that Dred Scott was not free, but the Supreme Court went much further than that. It said that Dred Scott, being black, was not even a citizen of the United States. Roger B. Taney's decision was kind of bizarre because he said that blacks could not be citizens of the United States.
But even if they were born here.
Even if they were born here, they could not become, they were not citizens of the United States. But in the dissent, especially the one by Benjamin Curtis, it was pointed out that blacks were citizens of many states, and in some northern states were even allowed to vote, and they were therefore American citizens. And so Dred Scott was not only declared not free, he was declared not a citizen. But it was even worse than that.
Oh my gosh.
Roger B. Taney and the majority of the Supreme Court went on to maintain that the Missouri Compromise, which was goes all the way back to 1820, the Missouri Compromise stated that any territory north of 36 degrees 30 minutes latitude could not be slave, but anything south of that could be slave. And it was one of those compromises worked out by Henry Clay, the great compromiser.
Sure.
It had actually been abolished in 1854 with the Kansas-Nebraska Act. So the Missouri Compromise line was no longer existent. But Roger B. Taney said the Missouri Compromise line was never constitutional, that you could not prohibit slave owners from taking their slaves anywhere in United States territory, even a place like Oregon Territory, which became free territory right from the get-go in 1846. And this created a storm of controversy. This is one of those many events of the 1850s that is leading the United States inexorably
to civil war.
Southerners hailed the decision because they looked upon slaves as property and you had the right to not have your property infringed upon. You could take it anywhere. Northerners felt it was a horrible decision. Many Northerners thought, my gosh, if you can't prevent slavery in any territory, even very far north territory like Oregon, what's next? Maybe you can't even prevent slavery in northern states. Even Abraham Lincoln opined to that effect. And Dred Scott decision is one of many reasons why Lincoln came out of retirement and entered politics again. Kansas-Nebraska Act was the main reason.
That's a terrible decision.
Many constitutional scholars feel that the Dred Scott decision is arguably the single worst decision ever
put forward. And they couldn't stop with just saying, oh, no, you're not free.
Yeah, they could have just
go even further.
That's right. They could have just said, no, look, you're not free. And they could have stopped at that.
Why didn't they?
But they didn't. He's not even a citizen. And, oh, by the way, the Missouri Compromise, which existed for 34 years, was never constitutional to begin with because Congress had no right to prevent slavery in any territory. Oh, it was a...
Do we know eventually what happened to Dred Scott?
He died the next year in 1858. He was, I think, freed in the last year of his life, and he died in 1858, so he never lived to see the Civil War.
I wonder how old he was when he died. Do we know?
A lot of times you never knew how old a slave was.
Because they didn't know.
Because
they
didn't keep any records. I mean, take the great writer and that magnificent black American, Frederick Douglass. All right? He wasn't sure what year he was born. He thought it might be 1818. But he couldn't be certain, let alone what month or day.
Wow.
So that was
just
typical.
Unfathomable.
Yeah. And yeah, the Dred Scott decision was an...
Terrible. Right. Terrible decision.
Yeah. It was just pretty bad.
Wow. Okay, so where do we go from Dred Scott? Oof.
Well, we're going to stay on racial issue here. We deal with the 1883 civil rights cases. This was a collection of five cases. And it had to do with the 14th Amendment. Now, the 14th Amendment became part of the Constitution in 1868 during the Reconstruction period after the Civil War. And the 14th Amendment prohibited a state from discriminating against a person on the basis of color.
Okay.
Well, all these cases come together to the Supreme Court in 1883, and the Supreme Court ruled, yes, that's correct. No state can discriminate against a person on the basis of color. But as an individual, you can.
Okay.
So states can't discriminate, but individuals can discriminate. And of course, this opened up the way for loads of individuals, white, to discriminate against blacks on the basis that, hey, I'm not part of the state. It's just me as an individual. And what's interesting about the Supreme Court cases in 1883 is they're still good law. A lot of people don't realize that.
Well,
as an
I did
individual...
not know that.
You have a right to be racially prejudiced. You can be a white who doesn't like blacks and says so, or you can be a black who doesn't like white and say so. You have the right to do that. But let's go the whole way forward to 1964.
Oh, okay, we're jumping.
It's a case called the Heart of Atlanta Motel. All right, that's the case.
That's the name of the case.
Heart of Atlanta Motel versus the United States. In this particular case, a motel owner in Georgia said he did not have to put up blacks at his motel, that he had the right as an individual to do this. And one of the things he pointed to, and he pointed to, his lawyers pointed to many things, was the 1883 Supreme Court cases.
Well, and segregation was the norm then.
And segregation was very much, and I was on the way out in 64, but just barely on the way out. The Civil Rights Act had just been passed that year and so on. Well, the Supreme Court in Heart of Atlanta Motel, 1964, They didn't do away with the 1883 Supreme Court cases. They didn't say, no, an individual doesn't have the right to be prejudiced. Oh, yes, yeah, you can be prejudiced as an individual. However, the Supreme Court used the Commerce Clause from Article 1, Section 8, that says, yes, that you can't interfere with interstate commerce. And a motel owner who is preventing blacks from staying in his motel is interfering with interstate commerce. And this was eventually applied to virtually any business, restaurants, motels, hotels, you name it. So they came through the back door
to the right decision.
To sustain the 1964 Civil Rights Act and to give teeth to the 14th Amendment passed in 1868 by saying that you can't discriminate against an individual based on interstate commerce being infringed upon. And that is still good law to this day.
Why couldn't they just say, hey, let's just not discriminate? How about
that? Well, that would go to freedom of speech. That would go to the First Amendment. You have the right to be a hater. What you don't have a right to do is to interfere with interstate commerce.
The irony.
And that's how they, and so that's why the 1883 Supreme Court cases, which upheld the right of an individual to be a racist, is still good law. But if you own any kind of business, you will be found to have interfered with interstate commerce by evincing your racism in a business capacity. It's very clever, actually.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that's still good law.
That's still good law. That is. Yes. Yes, indeed. Okay. We're still staying on racial matters. We come to a good example of how the Supreme Court can completely reverse itself on an issue. In 1896, there was a case called Plessy versus Ferguson.
Okay. Which a lot of people probably heard of.
Right. And in that case, in 1896, the Supreme Court said, basically, that separate but equal facilities for whites and blacks is constitutional. That you can have black first-class train passenger cars, you can have white first-class train passenger cars, you can have black schools, you can have white schools, and so on.
So continuing with the segregation.
Right. So it really continued. Now, as many people pointed out at the time, separate but equal will guarantee you that it will not be equal. There will always be one above the other. And that's exactly what happened in the entire Jim Crow era. Whites had many advantages over blacks, to put it mildly. Separate but equal will ensure...
Was not really
separate
but equal.
This was overturned in 1954 by Brown versus Board of Education, probably the single most important civil rights case of all time. In 1954, in Brown versus the Board of Education, Plessy versus Ferguson was overturned. And separate but equal was declared unconstitutional. And this began the integration of the schools and many other areas too, which took many, many years to achieve. It didn't occur
overnight. Oh, yeah, that doesn't happen overnight.
A lot of southern states particularly were very resistant to this. University of Mississippi in 62, University of Alabama in 63 didn't want to admit black students. It is a long story. That's a whole podcast of its own,
the
1960s civil rights movement. But what's interesting about this is there's a dictum in the law called stare decisis. Stare decisis means that the previous decisions of the court should be highly respected and not overturned unless you have a very, very good reason to overturn it. Well, Brown versus Board of Education was one of those good reasons. I had overturned Plessy versus Ferguson.
That wasn't the first time, though, that Supreme Court decision had been overturned.
No, but it is rare.
Okay.
It is rare.
It's certainly probably the most consequential.
I would say yes.
Overturned decision.
Most consequential. And, of course, Brown versus Board of Education 1954 was very controversial. A lot of individuals felt that that was wrong. It was a unanimous decision. Earl Warren had just become Chief Justice in 1953, and he had been the Republican governor of California, before that Attorney General of California, and he was appointed by Dwight Eisenhower. And at the time, a number of very liberal-oriented people thought that Earl Warren would be too conservative, but Earl Warren proved not to be that. He molded that court, and he was Chief Justice from 1953 to his retirement in 1969.
Wow, okay.
Right. And the Warren Court was famous for all kinds of decisions, Gideon versus Wainwright, the Miranda versus Arizona.
The Miranda rights.
1966, where an individual who's apprehended, who was charged with a crime, has a right to be told that he can be silent and all of that. He has a right to an attorney, etc. Mm-hmm. Some of the Warren court decisions were very controversial. One of them was, this doesn't have to do with race, this has to do with religion. This is the famous Engel versus Vitale case, 1962.
The name does not ring a bell, I'll be honest.
Yes, Engel versus Vitale, 1962. It was in New York. It started in New York. New York school system had a non-denominational, non-coercive school prayer.
In the public schools.
In the public schools of New York. And some 10 families who weren't religious or whatever, or maybe they were religious but thought that prayer in the public school was wrong, they sued. And it went the whole way to the Supreme Court.
I'm sorry. Repeat the year that this happened.
The Supreme Court decision is 1962.
62, okay.
Engel versus Vitale. And the Supreme Court ruled with one dissent that the prayer was unconstitutional, that it violated the First Amendment. Now, the one dissent was by Potter Stewart. And Potter Stewart made a very interesting point that William Rehnquist later on would make, too, in the 1980s. And that is that the First Amendment did not prohibit a voluntary, non-denominational school prayer in the public schools. What the First Amendment was about was not establishing a national church, like, say, the Episcopalian Church as the National Church of America, or the Presbyterian Church as the National Church of America. So Engel versus Vitale was a very controversial decision. I just would like to read the prayer
that was
declared unconstitutional. It's very brief. Here it is. Almighty God, we acknowledge our dependence upon Thee, and we beg Thy blessings upon us, our parents, our teachers, and our country. That's it.
That's it?
That's it. Now, I'm going to opine here. I'm going to give my own opinion.
Uh-oh.
Okay. I'm not a particularly religious man, as people who know
me well.
You're
not religious at all.
Okay, I'm not religious, but I have a great admiration for certain religions because of the ethic they put forward, especially the Judeo-Christian ethic, which I admire. I think Potter Stewart was correct in his dissent. I don't see how this violates the First Amendment. I don't think that the framers of the First Amendment, and that became part of the Constitution in 1791, would have objected to that prayer whatsoever.
I can't imagine they would have.
And it wasn't coercive. No student was forced to say it.
Oh, so they had the choice.
They had the choice. Now, some said, well, that, you know, a lot of students that weren't religious, it made them feel badly. Well, my response to that is the Constitution is not about feelings.
Yeah, it's like, welcome to life, kid.
Yeah, welcome to life, kid. Welcome to life, Johnny and Susie. Now, some people may think I'm being a bit too harsh, but that is my assessment. I do not see how this is unconstitutional, and I would...
You may not like it.
You may not like it, but that's
that
doesn't mean
different.
It's unconstitutional. And I would invoke Winston Churchill here. He said, to teach a person in the mind, but not in morals, is to create a menace to society. And a lot of people feel that the Engel versus Vitale case was the very beginning of the taking out of moral teaching in the school system.
Is there moral teaching nowadays in the school systems? Because it seems like with so many teachers and administrators, their hands are tied.
They are tied. I will opine again to the effect that I think in the modern school system, we have a situation in which students are told what to think far more than they are told how to think. And I think that's wrapped up with Engel versus Vitale as the genesis of this, what I would call, educational pedagogical error.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Anyway. So.
All right, do we have any more?
Well, we have the famous... we have the famous Bush versus Gore case.
Oh, yeah.
Right, 2000.
I think most of our listeners may perhaps remember that.
Yes, the Hanging Chads.
The Hanging Chads.
Right, in Florida. And the Florida Supreme Court stated that you had to have a recount in all the counties. It went the whole way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ruled 7-2 that it violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment because different counties, or 67 counties in Florida, different counties had different ways of counting. All right, and so that was violative. And then 5-4 decision was that the county had to stop. The Supreme Court of Florida was wrong, and at that point, Bush was declared the winner. This was very controversial.
Oh, yes. For many reasons.
Yes, so that the Bush versus Gore case is a classic example of just how strong the Supreme Court of the United States can be.
So not only did it go to the Florida court.
It went first to the Florida State Supreme Court. And the Florida State Supreme Court was very sympathetic to counting and recounting and recounting and so on. So eventually it went to the Supreme Court of the United States, and they said, nope, now we got to stop. And that was in December of 2000, and Bush was declared.
What was the split on that?
Well, on the Equal Protection Clause, it was 7-2. On the Florida State Supreme Court demand that the entire state engage in a recount, it was 5-4.
Oh, against. That's a close one.
Yeah, very close.
So I guess it's debatable on whether that was the right decision or not.
Yes, there were many people that were dissatisfied with that, but welcome to democracy.
Yeah, I guess so. That had to go all the way to the Supreme Court.
Yep, went all the way to the Supreme Court. The election was in early November, and the Supreme Court decided it in early December.
So yeah, that was a long wait to find out.
Took about 5 weeks, yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, what else do we have?
So does that wrap it up?
No, I think we can deal with the whole affirmative action matter, which gets back to racial matters. There was an interesting case in 1978 called the Bakke case. Bakke was this ex-Marine who applied to medical school at the University of California, Davis, was denied entry. He was white. He did some research, and he found out that he had done, you know, the MSAT scores, and he had better grades than certain blacks that were admitted to Cal Davis Medical School. So he sued. Now, this took many years, eventually reached the Supreme Court in 1978, and the Supreme Court ruled for Bakke. The Supreme Court said that you could not have a quota system because I think it was 16 out of 100 places were allotted to minorities. And so the Bakke case did not disallow affirmative action. It just said race could be taken into account as one of many factors in the admission process, but you just can't have a quota system.
Which it seems like that's where we're headed right now.
Well, then if you jump forward to 2003, there were two cases out of the University of Michigan, the Grutter case and the Grotz case. And the Supreme Court on the same day in 2003 ruled basically in favor of what Bakke had done, that you could take race into account, but you couldn't have a point system, which was kind of like a quota system. But race can be one of many factors in determining admissions policy. Now, Sandra Day O'Connor, who was the first female on the United States Supreme Court, she was appointed by Ronald Reagan, she wrote the opinion in the Grutter case, and her point was that, well, maybe some 25 years from now, we won't have to take race into account. Well, 25 years from 2003 would be 2028, and Clarence Thomas wrote a dissent saying, wait a minute, if it's going to be unconstitutional in 25 years, it's unconstitutional now. And it's 25 years waiting period doesn't really add up. So it was very controversial, as affirmative action matters are to this day.
So is affirmative action still in place?
Essentially, yes. Many people feel that while quota systems and point systems are not constitutional, that if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. And that, in fact, quotas and point systems are implicitly used. This is a very controversial matter to this day.
Absolutely, especially considering everything that happened this summer and all the inward reflecting everybody's doing and on a corporate level. And
right. Race has been a factor in American history from colonial times onwards.
I wonder if we'll ever get to a point where it's not a factor.
I hope so.
I
would like it to get to a point where what Martin Luther King said in 1963 is the case, where a person would be judged not on their race or their ethnicity or their gender, but on the content of their character.
We still haven't been able to implement that.
No, but that's the ideal, and we have to strive for that ideal. Ultimately, biological characteristics should not matter.
Yeah, because nobody can help their sex or their race.
Yeah. And now we have some reverse racism. We were just listening last night to how Coca-Cola was putting out something to the effect that people should be less white who are white. This is ridiculous. This is nonsense. Okay, I don't want black people to be less black. I don't want white people to be less white. I don't want Asians to be less Asian.
Just be who you are and be respectful.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of.
Why is that so hard?
Many times mankind is an idiot.
That might be an understatement.
So
it's true. Well, it's something to strive for, especially as we're at the end of February here.
Yes, and just one more case.
Holy smokes. Okay.
One more case, very controversial in the eyes of many. This is Obergefell versus Hodges, 2015. This is a Supreme Court case that said that gay marriage was constitutional both for equal protection purposes and due process purposes of the 14th Amendment, and that all 50 states had to abide by gay marriage. It couldn't be a state-by-state matter up until 2015.
Which it was at that point,
up
right?
Until 2015 it was, yes. I think by that time, over 30 states had legitimized gay marriage. It might have been as many as 35, 37 or something like that. But this made it the law of the land. And of course, many were upset by that. Many felt that marriage should be between a man and a woman, not between people of the same gender. This remains controversial to this day, but Obergefell versus Hodges, 2015.
What was the split on that? Do we know?
Oh, it was 5-4, if I'm not mistaken. It was very close.
Oh, was it very close?
Yeah, yes. In fact, I'm sure it was 5-4, and it was Justice Kennedy that was the swing vote and went with the majority.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so it was just barely. But it doesn't make any difference, folks, if it's 9-0 or 5-4. It's still the law of the land.
Right. It's the majority.
Right. Right. I mean, Brown versus Board of Education in 1954 was a 9-0 decision. It was unanimous.
Wow. How often does that happen in the Supreme Court?
Not as infrequently as you might think. It does happen, yes.
I would think that'd be rare, but...
Right. There you have it, folks, a handful of controversial Supreme Court cases.
That were consequential.
Starting with the mother of all Supreme Court cases, Marbury versus Madison, 1803.
Which the case itself...
Yeah, a minor matter, but a momentous result with Marbury versus Madison, yes.
Amazing.
Absolutely.
Well, that wraps it up then. It's funny, I've been trying to wrap it up for the last 20 minutes. Sorry about that, folks.
I have another 20 or 30 cases.
I know you do. Believe me, I know you do.
But enough is enough.
I know. 40 minutes, that's a good workout on the treadmill for people to listen to
our podcast. Oh, God, yes.
So
all right.
I think we're good here.
Oh, the humanity.
Oh, yes, indeed. Okay, so we're in March. Hey,
yeah.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
And I guess...
What?
We don't know what we're doing.
We don't know what
we're
doing in 2 weeks. I don't know.
All right. Well, until then, everyone, stay well, stay safe, stay sane. We're close to spring. That's a beautiful thing.
Yes, it's a wonderful thing.
And we'll see you...
When we do.
When we do.
Okay.
All right. Happy Wednesday, everyone.
Goodbye.
Well, friends, here we are at the end of the podcast. Be sure to check out the links in the show description to find some of the resources we used for this episode. Also, if you've enjoyed listening, please head over to Apple Podcasts and give us a virtual high five by leaving us a 5-star review. We'd really appreciate that. And if you'd like to connect with us directly, you can find us at historicallyspeakingpodcast.com or follow us on Instagram at historicallyspeakingpodcast. That's it for today. And again, thanks for sharing part of your day with us. And remember, if you want to know what the future holds, study the past.